everybody, thanks for joining us on another episode of This Is Hot Boga. Make sure to head over to iTunes and Podbean and give us a subscribe. If you're feeling frisky, give us a 5-star review.
And give us some nice comments. All right. This episode of This Is Hot Boga is brought to you by Sturka Optics. If you want to see clear, see far, put on these binoculars and take a look-see. Best optics on the market, Sturka Optics.
FHF Gear has really found a way to pair functionality of the hunting and fishing industry with a little bit of the utility and durability of tactical gear to produce some really unique and high-quality outdoor gear using a design that's they're proudly made in America and backed by a warranty that exhibits not only their confidence, but also their belief in customer service. So FHF Gear, fish, hunt, fight.
Podcasts like ours are brought to you by New Breed Archery. I'm not very good at archery, but I still like to shoot my bow. And so I like to hit the target, not lose arrows, which is why I use New Breed Archery. Go to newbreed.com and order yourself a bow. All right. Next one is Black Eagle Arrows. I miss the target a lot, and I have yet to break a Black Eagle Arrow. I don't know why. I don't know what kind of voodoo magic they use to make these things so strong, but I love it. Check them out. Jared, do you use a rangefinder when you're out hunting?
I do, yeah.
What if I told you that you could get a bow sight with the rangefinder built in? So you look at it, something far away, you push the button, it'll tell you the range and it'll adjust your sight for you. Would you be interested in that?
I'd tell you you're crazy.
Well, I'm not. Burris makes such a bow sight. So go to burrisoptics.com to learn more. Hey, Jared.
Hey, what's up, Jim?
Did you know there's a camo out there that'll break up your silhouette no matter what season or what terrain you're in?
Yep.
Who told?
Joe Fichter. Now go get yourself a pair at ASO Camp.
Say ASAP in a minute.
ASAP.
Yeah, there we go. All right. Hey.
Go get yourself.
Who told?
Well, Joe Fichter. Now go get yourself a pair at ASAPCamo.com.
Man, Joe.
Good to hear that you guys are on top of each other. That's good.
Well, all right. Hey, now.
Joe.
It's not being recorded yet.
No, and well, hey, that's just the kind of humor Hot Boga's all about.
That's right. Hey, Joe.
There he is.
Hey, welcome. Sorry.
So we're all on. We got Carl on here. We're talking a little bit about how he lives in a more beautiful place than us for for the most part.
I'm not going to rub it in.
He's not rubbing it in, but he is sending me pictures of what it looks like. Actually, it was Hell's Canyon, but still like a nice sunset over like a beautiful mountain.
That's awesome.
Well, Carl, let's get started. You want to tell me a little bit about who you are? And I know you just got a new job. Maybe fill us in a little bit on what that is.
Well, since I'm a lot older than you guys, I grew up in Eastern Oregon. My dad was an active outdoorsman and backcountry hunter. He was a gunsmith, had an injury, and this is Veterans Day just a day or so ago, so it made me think of him. But yeah. He had a ruptured eardrum, got out of the military just prior to Pearl Harbor. And so went into munitions manufacturing in Twin Cities and TW head stamp on anything that you guys may ever see from World War II. But he became a machinist and he came, infatuated with guns that could shoot a long ways. So his father told him after the war that he should move out west. And he followed his brother out west, loved guns, became a gunsmith, and then had a sporting goods store near the end of his life, and he built fiberglass boats. And so I was on water, I was on horses, I was in the backcountry, mostly in Eastern Oregon. We traveled just close from home. And
they have water out west? Do they have water out west? I didn't see much of it when I was just in Colorado.
Let's see. In rivers, yep. And then that fills that big ocean. And then it's kind of like Michigan with those big old lakes. We've got some reservoirs we created with these incredible dams.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a whole nother story. But so I just ended up following my dad at about 9 years old, just loving being out and just doing what he did. And so that was my love of hunting and outdoors. And I had a brother-in-law that my sister was involved with prior to marriage that was just kind enough as a mentor outdoors to just drag me around. I'm very blessed to have, at 11, to have him run me all over the country, and actually at 12 let me hunt with him. I killed my first buck with him.
Wow. Yeah, that's awesome. What do you do now?
Well, I retired out of the fire service 2 years ago, about 37 years in the fire service, and I've always just been a volunteer and helped do lots of things. That's how I started in the fire service. But most recently, I took a job with the Oregon Hunters Association, about a 10,000 member organization of hunters in Oregon that I am now the unofficial, because they haven't put a title or a business card to my name yet, but I'm the conservation director for lands. So lots of issues out west and in Oregon in particular that I'll be keeping my finger on. It's very rewarding. I love being connected to the lands, and I'm kind of a self-study. I just continue to try to grow and understand and learn about, you know, our lands and how to keep them in public hands and all the things we can do to make them better.
How long have you been at this job?
I was in my third week.
Third week, okay.
I was on the board. Yeah, I was on the board of directors. I'm a life member of Oregon Hunters. I'm a life member of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. I'm a life member of Traditional Archers of Oregon, and there'll be others to come as I grow this, I guess, conservation resume. I can't stop giving back to the land, and you know, between volunteering still for various projects like an Adopt a Highway for my business, just things to try to make it better world that we live in. I guess that's kind of my motto or my creed, I guess.
Yeah, that's really cool. So kind of your hunting has kind of fueled that passion, or were you passionate about public lands even before you really got into hunting?
Well, if we turn that whole question around, was that James?
Yeah.
If we turn that whole question around, I wouldn't have an outdoor business if I didn't have public lands to put my products into people's hands,
right,
to make them have a better experience. So growing up with it 4 blocks from my house, it's funny, I used to carry my 20 gauge along the side of my leg and walk through the alleys of our neighborhood till I got to public land with my dog and so I could go pheasant hunt. And I do the same for duck hunting, and pretty soon I learned to ride a bike, and I got the nickname 10 speed because I'd have a bag of decoys on my back and a shotgun and my dog run alongside of me. And I'd go out of town, dash the bike, and I'd make a big loop, and I'd hunt rivers and creeks and canals. And back then, public lands was everything. It was your neighbor's field and his canal. That just didn't get upset at a young man with a shotgun. And
right.
Trespassing was a lot different back then than it appears to be now.
You got more anyway, place to wander.
Yeah, I'm blessed. Like we talked about, you know, places with public lands, we're blessed out west, and I just don't want to take that for granted. So I've always tried to look at that as it's such a gift, and I try to spend as much time. It's difficult now with a part-time job, but I actually have more leniency with that job than I do my personal business. I've found that a hunting business, products for hunters, it's a little more demanding, and I don't get away as often as I'd like.
Hmm. You know, it's funny. A lot of people out east seem to say, you know, oh, out west, they have all this private or public land, and, you know, it's kind of affects them more. But, you know, growing up, we were our land attached to my great grandpa bought 80 acres actually before he retired, didn't have a house on it. He was in a different state. Eventually he moved up there and retired and lived up there. But his 80 acres butted up to a couple thousands of land of a couple thousands of acres of state land. And so growing up, I really didn't know, you know, I didn't have an end. I could just go.
Right. Yeah.
Which, you know, and as you kind of have already alluded to, that's huge, especially for at least me as a young boy. You know, I had a 22, a shotgun, a single shot 20 gauge that I'd bring out and have a lot of fun.
Those are great stories. And those are the memories we all have. And same for me. And times have changed a little bit. It's kind of difficult to summarize that, how it's changed, but it's sad to see some of the changes. And I think that's why our hunter numbers are in decline in a number of ways. You know, my friends here in Oregon that were in Michigan have the same stories. A lot of them hunted the Upper Peninsula. Mm-hmm. I feel like the glove or the mitten state is kind of like my cousin or my long lost child state. I have so many friends from Michigan here in Bend, but it's sounds very, very outdoorsy between the fishing and the hunting in that state. I think it's great.
Yeah, like a very rich hunting tradition, which is great
and
not so great.
Yeah.
The great part is, I mean, hunting is like a thing where, that everybody does.
It's basically opening day, you get the day off of school.
Yeah.
A lot of schools.
Yeah, right.
which is great, but you also have some of the lasting parts of that legacy are, you know, people's approach to what to shoot, especially, you know, a generation or two older than, you know, I am. For them, it was you shoot a buck no matter the size, whatever a legal buck was. And obviously that they had different maybe conservation goals back when they were young. But now it the, kind of the impact of that is we are the size of our bucks are not as big. And so parts of the state have enacted, you know, the APR zone or the antler point restriction zones and stuff. And actually, I think they've expanded it even further into down to Kent, which is where we are. Hmm. So, but yeah, I mean, so there's some good and bad. It's but there's a lot of hunting tradition. I mean, I think Hemingway did some a bit of fishing and stuff up here. And you know, Fred Bear and you talk Ted Nugent and all those guys. Those are all Michigan guys. Steve Ranella, too. Yeah, it's interesting how much that plays an impact even probably for kids growing up having all their heroes be in the same state as them. So Joe, are you with us?
I am, but was I getting feedback on my end? I know Tom can edit this out later. What was coming through? I'm just curious.
It just sounded like you were rubbing the microphone on your coat.
Ah, it was. Ooh. It was the string rubbing my zipper. It's cold. It's cold here.
Yeah, it's cold here too. We got a space heater next to us and I'm still cold.
We're getting, we're supposed to get freezing rain tomorrow morning. East side of the state's going to get 4 inches of snow. We're just going to get frozen rain. It's going to be lovely.
You told me that you weren't going to because of that. I think you man up and get out there.
Freezing rain. Let me ask you young guys a question. Did you used to get freezing rain, you know, in your winters as you grew up?
Oh, yeah.
Or was it always snow?
No, okay. Freezing rain and snow.
Yeah. Freezing rain's a new phenomenon out west. And
really?
Especially in higher elevations. Yeah. And so we haven't seen that warm air over the top of cold air out here as much in the West. And we're seeing it way more in the last 20 years than I ever saw it in my first 20 years in Bend.
Because of pollution.
So there's a lot of reasons, but yeah. We got to talk about the climate eventually.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely the, you know, the thinning ozone layer and all the pollutants in the air. I can see that changing the dynamics of the atmosphere.
So I can't say that Michigan over 10 years ago, whether it had or had not had freezing rain. I think I was 10 at best. So I don't remember the weather from back then. So maybe it was the case in Michigan. I can't say.
Well, I'm from Pennsylvania. And you guys are from Michigan, and we're located around those industrial hubs like Detroit, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, where I think that we've seen the climate changing well before the West has, as he was like saying, like the different phenomenons with the weather and the freezing rain and the black snow. And I can see that. It's interesting. So what you're saying is in the past 20 years, you're just starting to see freezing rain up in the mountains?
Yeah, our snow levels seem to rise. I volunteer for a Nordic ski group out here because a lot of my friends, like they're Michiganders that are Nordic people that moved to Bend for a little longer season. We all talk about that stuff because they love to talk. And one of the phenomenons we've seen is this rising snow level. So our club has a ski area up at we build a yurt and we build a warming shed and a grooming shed and all the things that go on. You know, we cut trails and we cut firewood and we stock all of our shelters. And one of the things we noticed in last year in particular was such a shortened snow season and then rain at our elevation. And we're about 5,400 feet. Mount Bachelor, the big ski area, is seeing way more rain phenomenon on top of snow. So its base is 6,300, goes up to 9,000 feet. So that change in the West is going to affect so many things.
Well, do you see that as a direct effect of air pollutants?
Well, that's hard to say. We're the first ones to get pollutants from China. I know it's documented. In fact, they NOAA put some sort of sensor on top of Mount Bachelor. It's one of the highest peaks that first get, you know, pollutants from the West, and they've actually documented things coming out of China. In fact, when those big dust storms happen out in the, I was going to tell you the name of that, the Gobi, but whatever the desert is out there in the south of China, and they pick up that dust first thing up on Mount Bachelor, which is again at 9,000 feet in the Cascade Range.
So you're kind of attributing it more to solid particle pollutants like dust, dirt, earth than man-made pollutants, or a combination?
Well, I think it's a combination. I'm not expert that way, but I know that
neither am I.
various places have had, you know, sand arrive onto a snowpack and increase the rate at which it melts. So those kind of things are important that we, you know, try to come up with, you know, ideas on how to mitigate that kind of problem, or what to do to capture water, or how to, you know, eliminate pollutants. That's some of the stuff that intrigues me, but that's not a part of my job description, not quite yet.
It's pretty cool. I mean, I couldn't even imagine the complexity to that. I mean, we constantly bitch out east here about the changing of the seasons, where we don't get snow until January and it lasts until May. I mean, this year I turkey hunted in several days of snow, and how the seasons don't stack up, the hunting seasons don't align like they used to with the weather. I can't scientifically say, but it sure seems to me, as a person that's outside a lot, that things are changing.
Yeah, we just noticed a shift, the theme of what you described. It's kind of weird, but, you know, and maybe it's anecdotal, I don't know, but it just seems like that's what's happening, and a lot of people notice it as well. And that connection with the land is really, in weather, is really, you know, intriguing to me, because I think that's got some validity in the things that we sense in our lives and our world and what's going on. So it makes us a little more heightened awareness of how we conduct our business, you know, whether we drive less or whatever. I think it's
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as just from a hunting perspective, I mean, I take mental note, and I've noticed that, I mean, because a lot of animal behavior and timing of breeding seasons and stuff is on the amount of daylight we're receiving and stuff like that. But with the different weather patterns and with the seasons almost seeming like they shift, I think it's also changing the actual timing of the seasons for the animals, who don't go by a calendar or a game laws book. They go by nature and just another day to them, but it's all timing to them. And I'm seeing what I feel like is the shifting of the peak of the seasons being out of season, so to speak.
Yeah. And I agree with that, at least from my perspective in Oregon. So, you know, it'd be interesting to have others weigh in.
Especially
on that,
yeah, like other, well, states. and then also to get the scientific empirical knowledge that some, but it's curious, because I mean, the game in my state, the game commission, you know, there's reasons why the seasons come in when they do and go out when they do. And it's for, like, in the spring for turkey season, it's for the protection of the poults and for the nesting hens, and also the time it to maximize the success for hunters to hit part of the breeding season. The same with archery in the fall, it's made to pick up that rut and the peak activity to keep the hunters interested and for them to see the maximum amount of deer activity that they can. So yeah, it's kind of interesting, and I'm curious to see if in my lifetime I see a shift of the game seasons.
Yeah, I think you will.
I firmly believe I will too. I mean, I do. I just, I mean, you gotta, we've actually found it. When they're hot, you gotta capitalize. You gotta make things happen. You gotta adjust work schedules. You gotta use vacation days, use sick days, do what you gotta do, because it seems like that peak time, like I can remember as a child turkey hunting, and it seemed like we spent the preseason scouting and the birds were hot, and then during the season, we were working birds all through the season. Now it seems like you've got that first 2-week window, and after that, tactics change drastically because the bird's behavior has changed so drastically.
Sounds like a good book you're going to write.
If I could find the time, I got a couple of them. They're on the chalkboard, and they're just
going to need some editing, though.
Grammar and English. I'll need a grammar and English person. We've had, I bet you I'm in, a dozen text conversations right now on my phone about the rut and how it was such a dud here in South Western PA and even into parts of West Virginia.
Even by us, we didn't have, I saw some for younger bucks. I didn't see any really good, big mature bucks really doing anything ruddy this year.
And it was a dismal season. And as far as rutting activity, now our Pennsylvania general archery season ended with many guys scratching their head, wondering what happened to the rut.
Well, I've seen a little bit of it. Joe guys, Joe, he's not even affected by the rut.
He's good about the rut.
Joe was going to put a buck down.
I capitalized on what I was seeing, and I made it happen. You have to. And a lot of guys, though, they're going with their time-honored strategies of how they hunt the rut during this time phase and this phase of the, if you believe in the 13 phases of the deer season, the fall, as the juries, as they map out, they were following their time-honored strategies and tactics, and they weren't working. They weren't adjusting, and a lot of them are eating tag soup right now. But I noticed it, and now this—it's not just the season changing, or maybe it's the daylight's changing, or the amount of daylight, or however it was, because we still had rolled the clocks back for whatever fall back, and then we do the spring ahead. I don't know how much of that has an effect on it. I don't obviously watch how much daylight we're having or stuff like that. I watch, we've talked about this, the moon, and I watch deer behavior in my area. But EHD crushed us this year. And I think that had a lot to do with it too. So it may not just be weather or timing, but I mean, the EHD literally crushed us in the bottom part of the state here and then into West Virginia.
Yeah. Hey, Carl, how was your, you don't do any bow hunting, do you?
Yeah, I'm a traditional archer.
Another one.
I know it's sad, but it's the only way to go. being raised with a lot of rifles, my dad was a gunsmith. We had a gun safe full of guns, and I decided about 97 or 98 when I took a couple elk within archery range with a rifle that just wasn't me. It wasn't right. It wasn't ethical. It wasn't a challenge anymore. So my first year, I grabbed the longbow. And I easily got my ass handed to me in that game. And the two guys I was hunting with that were trying to teach me some archery both had compounds, and I ended up the caller. And I learned a lot, and they loved my calling, and it worked well. But I don't ever think I would hunt with compound guys with the trad bow unless we were really good at trading off who's the shooter and who's not. And anyway, long and short of that is, I love traditional archery. I did it as a kid, but I fell back in love with it. My father, being a gunsmith, would just chuckle at me, and he handed me one of those little red fiberglass bows with a white handle. I'll never forget the first bow I had, and would fling some arrows with it at probably 8 or 9 years old, and he'd giggle at me, and he'd said, "Well, you can shoot them a lot farther away with this thing," and he'd have a gun out. And so I just never really felt the need until I had just a ethical challenge to myself and said, I don't just need to have more of a challenge. I just need to give the animal a fair shake. So I ended up traditional archery. In my second year, I decided the longbow was a little steep learning curve. And I had a lot of opportunities with that bow. There's no doubt. I look in retrospect the next year. But I bought my friend from the group there, one of his older compounds, and I killed a deer and elk the next year. And it reminded me that it was more like a gun. And I just didn't want that anymore. And so I'll do my gun thing occasionally since I have a gun safe full of guns. But I just found that the fun of shooting arrows all day at stumps and the things like that that traditional archery brings was just more intimate with the animal and all the fun. My girls each have my youngest has a longbow. My older one, she's a 13-year-old, has a recurve, and they love to shoot. And we put our targets up on our 5 acres, and they just have so much pride and enjoyment with shooting, instinctual. And you see them getting better, and you just see that learning curve compressing, and it's really fun. And I got my wife a bow a couple years ago. It was an antique wing. She's got a like 60s version wing, 40 pounder, and she loves shooting it. I don't anticipate her hunting with a bow for some time. Oregon just lowered the bow weights for deer and elk, unfortunately, but
40 is actually pretty high for a woman archer. It seems that's a lot.
Well, she's a strong girl. Yeah, she grew up on a dairy farm where I did, and she's solid. She probably beat me in Indian leg wrestling any day, and maybe in arm wrestling too. She's a solid girl, and she's strong. She killed her first buck this year. I should text you that one too, James. But She just embraced hunting as her dad never took her. And I think that's another conversation for you guys. You do a lot of these podcasts, and that's kind of a new thing for an old guy. But I think it's important that we look at women as a group and include them in so many other ways. I'm encouraging a woman here in Oregon to get on the board position that I vacated to take the job. We just need more women advocates out there for hunting. And then the other thing I think it's important is these young ladies, if we want to increase hunter numbers, obviously young ladies have to have mentors and women that are hunters, and otherwise they're never going to get in. And they're such a low percentage, but yet low hanging fruit. And like my girls, my 13-year-old's ready to hunt. She just wants to hunt. And I look at her sideways. I say, really, you want to kill a deer? She's yep. And I'm baffled. And the youngest one hasn't mentioned anything about it yet, but these kind of interactions, and we go camping a lot. We have fun talking about animals and why, and we butcher our own, and they help.
Yeah,
you know, these are the things that I think that more people have to just integrate into their lives and make it a part of their life. That we harvest, or we, and I don't like that word necessarily, but I just think that killing, we get so soft inside about the word killing, and and societal, I think, but I kill an animal just like they kill a butcher a pig in a slaughterhouse or a cow, but we know it's organic and we know where it comes from, and we learn a lot of skills and things about nature.
But they might be organic by you, but by us, I don't know that we could even consider our deer organic. They're spending most of their time in I would assume GMO cornfields, so yeah. You know, I don't know that our, you know, you get out west and in the mountains and stuff, it might be a little different, but, you know, I always see like harvest organic meat, and it's like, I don't know that that's technically true. Harvesting, we're not growing.
No, yeah. I like that statement. You're absolutely right. And I think that's something that there's some problems with GMO all over the board, and I could go on and on about that ad nauseum. But I first was back in Wyoming years ago with some outlaws. Those were my in-laws that I'm divorced from. But I grew up loving the ideal whitetail, because that's all I would read in magazines. And we now are having, you know, whitetail spread into Oregon. But when I was in Wyoming with the ex-outlaws, or in-laws, I guess they are, we would see these whitetails in Wyoming, and then go into Nebraska, and they're all in the cornfield. And it was such a foreign landscape. Oh gosh, they're wonderful, and Alberta's got those beautiful giant bucks. But yeah, I think you're onto something there. They're eating corn, and you ever see what King Corn, I think it was, or Corn's King, the documentary on corn?
I think I saw it on Netflix or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So you definitely have the corn in the DNA of whitetails where you guys live. Yeah, it's a truth, and I think that we'll learn, just like in your guys' lifetime, that maybe GMO isn't the best thing that we could ever do for our bodies and our you know, societies. Definitely agricultural wise, it may keep us from some, you know, we can have some drought tolerant and other varietals of corn, but when we create a monoculture in our, you know, in our world, it's just not a good thing. And we'll see it with pine trees and all the other things that we think we're so smart and we can outsmart nature, but we're going to be I think we're always a step behind. But I'd like to say that we are getting whitetails in Oregon, when Oregon has a number of whitetail hunts. That's kind of a new thing.
Oh, that's awesome. I didn't know that they made it out there.
Yeah.
Have you been out for them?
Yeah. I haven't. I applied for my nephew, who's a big soccer kid. I mean, that's the other thing that's keeping kids out of hunting and whatnot. He lives in Portland. He's an urban kid. And he so wants, when he comes to Bend, to just shoot bows and shoot guns and be outdoors. Yep. And he's always got soccer on weekends. And I applied for a whitetail hunt up in northeastern Oregon, and where they're coming out of Washington, Idaho. And yet he couldn't go, because he only had weekends. And I was going to make every effort to make it happen, but it just didn't happen. And now it'll be 17 next year, and it's rough. You know, we lose these kids sometimes, and sometimes they start up something, you know, that's unfamiliar to them because of mentors when they're a little older. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's actually a really good topic I'm going to ask you about. The hunter numbers are decreasing, or at least we're seeing it, which is interesting because it seems like for a while we saw the rise of the hunting industry for so long where, you know, so much money is in it. But now you're seeing, you know, declining numbers. Is that there are not enough people taking their kids out? Is that, you know, older generations just not as interested? Where do you think that comes from?
Well, I think you nailed a couple of them. I think there's a lot more, too. I had a discussion with a client that guided an archery season last year, and he lives out of Seattle. And he makes it a point to get his girls involved. He's got two girls like myself. He makes it a point to get them involved and make it a point to make hunting a priority so they don't ever lose that, whether they hunt, you know, after they move out of the house, who knows. My brother-in-law's got three girls, and every one of them hunts. And he's taking his middle daughter on an elk hunt here shortly in Oregon. And he's made it a priority. It's his lifestyle.
Yeah.
So as our lifestyles change and sports, I was a big sports kid, but I just couldn't live without hunting. I don't know what I'd do.
Well,
it's not like hiking. It's just different. It's so purpose-based in so many ways. And we could go on and do a whole nother podcast and a half on all that stuff. But
well, you're just paying attention to different things. Yeah. And it's funny when you get a kid interested in it, man, they are like, you know, my daughter is six and she is, she's a rabid deer hunter. She's probably one of my best hunting partners now. She'll sit out as long as I will, as long as I keep her warm. And she watches me. She helps me gut it, helps me butcher it. You know, I remember she was three. You know, I started taking her out right after she turned three and got a deer. And, I mean, she's sitting there cheering me on as I'm, you know, cutting it up. Like, nice cut, Dad, you know. And I think that's the kind of thing that maybe that's not so much the case anymore.
Well, and with the generation that's on their phones all the time, too. And it's just so screen oriented with the, you see this now too, where millennials are so experience focused, right? Well, they're seeking real experiences. I don't know anything more real than a successful hunt.
Right.
To get a kid excited.
Here's what I always think happens. They'll be on their phone the entire time on a ride somewhere. They're not looking out the window in the car and seeing all the mountains. They get out, take a quick picture, a selfie that shows that they've been doing something interesting.
Get the likes.
Post it.
Yeah.
And then go back on their phone to play games or to like other people's pictures.
We brought a few of our cousins hunting in this.
Yeah, like we've got some pretty. And it's just like, that's first of all, it's just veneer. That's nothing real. And secondly, you know, I think that kind of culture is not good for hunting. And it's, you know, I struggle with it. I'm sitting out there and if I get service and I get bored, you know, you sat for a couple hours, you're a little cold. I start reading about the Chicago Bears
and
the phenomenal season that they're having.
shout
out to the Bears. We're a pro Bears podcast
officially when
Jared's not on because he's a Lions fan. But, you know, it's hard not to with a cell phone and having access wherever you are, for sure.
Especially when you're not seeing anything.
Yeah.
I do the same. I catch my cell phone.
You guys don't want to know the story when I was in Idaho in 96 that I was waiting for technology. There was no real cell tower development out west at that point. It's still developing here.
Yeah,
but
still not much.
I did have cell service in Hells in a place we called a phone booth, Better Than Ever, which I'm disappointed because, yes, I did what you said, and I was on my phone a little more and actually could call from my fire I made in camp that one night. For some reason, had three bars. I'm like, what is this? Now I'm in the wilderness and I've got cell service. But we are addicted to our phones, unfortunately. You know, who'd have thunk we'd had a computer more powerful than I had in high school in my hand? It's crazy. But
it's the thickness of a couple business cards, too. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's hard to give that up, and it's in our mindset, I guess. And unfortunately, what I try to do with my kids, and I think you guys are right on when you take your kids out younger. I started my kids in little tents with a wood stove, and we did it the hard way while friends were in camp trailers. And I think you kind of taking your kids out hunting younger is almost better. I feel like you've locked them in to some degree, whereas a little older, they're you know. Just kind of set in their ways. And I hate to say it, like older people when they get married are a little set in their ways, but these analogies that we make, you know, are real, and we can see them, and we really have a challenge to how to hook these younger kids into doing it. And it sounds like, was that Tom or Joe that said they had the little ones, or James?
That's James.
Yeah, little ones that went out. Yeah. So James, you know, I think you're on the right track, and you probably have a great partner there, and I admire that, and I think that's what more dads and moms need to do.
It's fun. And actually, you know, I've been telling these guys, I just got my first, speaking of traditional, my first, you know, recurve kill. And I'm hunting out of pretty much an abandoned barn. Mm-hmm. And I had three kids, all under the age of eight, or one was eight, two were six. And one was obviously my daughter, and, still got it done. And they were loving it. I mean, it was so exciting for me, because it's like, you know, they were quiet. They were very serious the whole time. You know, they knew this was like the real deal. The doe walked out. And, I mean, I was more nervous just because they were there, which was so much fun. And they got to help.
Yeah.
I got to watch gut it the next day. They helped me, you know, butcher the whole thing. And then we had heart together, which was pretty cool. And which is
absolutely
another thing, maybe a tangent that I'll go on at a different time, but I tell people that I feed my daughter heart, and that everybody is horrified. Is that a horrifying thing? I mean, are you guys, would you guys do that?
No, I think so many folks are out of touch, and you know, you look at all the ethnicities that are out there. I mean, I had Basque, and then few people know who the Basque are, but I had Basque godparents, and you should see the stuff they made. Oh, yeah. Lord. And everything from tongue and Hispanic world, you know, tongue is one of those things, and the squid we ate. But these folks years ago used every part of the animal. And that's an ethic we've lost as well that I'd love to see come back. But I admire people like Clay Hayes and these others that really show. And I, God bless Steve Rinella. You know, getting things like trichinosis from bears, you know, you don't want that. But you gotta get some sensibilities about this. I'm just not sure about how to make this intestine into sausage.
Right.
Let's not do it until you learn. But in this day and age, you can learn anything off of YouTube, apparently. So I just think that the time in the field is so important. And you nailed it, James, with all the kids. There's a game commissioner now that has got out of the Idaho Game Commission, a friend of mine, due to an issue in Africa. And ethics and the perceptions are changing. And as we as hunters, I think we just have to portray a little finer line. I'm not going to say it's like politically correct, but we need to have a finer line in a context that we are all speaking the same language. And if you want to use harvest for your kill, do it. I don't want to be the script miser. I don't want to be the guy that's writing it. Oh, this is how we do it. But we've got video folks out there that are addicted to hunting videos, and some of the ethics that go on there are poor. We all know the loss rates from this, that, and the other. As a guide, I saw some horrible loss rates, and I'm not going to pick on the compound people and light arrows. It's a passion of mine to have a heavy arrow and a traditional bow. It's other people's choice of what's a challenge to them. But I think we as hunters have to be the ethics police. I think we need to be up on our game. I think we really need to think about what is important for the longevity, sustainability of our sport. And it's more of a sport. It's a lifestyle. It's a heritage. It's a legacy. All those things we can come up with. But that's parts of why I'm involved in one, I guess, the Oregon Hunters, and doing what I'm doing for conservation. And I want to just pose one more thing before we end, is that I've got a book on the whiteboard like you guys might have. One of the things I want to bring up, and I'll try not to belabor the point, but I'm disappointed with so much that I've seen over the last maybe 10 years with media and all the video productions, that I want to say, or at least ask, you know, when did hunting become killing? And why are we so obsessed with the kill and watching an animal get an arrow? And why are we obsessed with this? Because that's not what I'm out there for. I had an incredible trick, the most challenging and physical trip of my life at 54 to go into this country. And years ago, I took a friend at 71 from Michigan into Hell's Canyon for his first bull. But I want to just reflect on the adventure and the ethic and the things we see, the other peripherals that are there when we experience the outdoors. That's what it's about. Those kids, their expressions and what they did and what was going to happen was exciting to them. And I really feel like as a hunter, the kill is the least important. Yeah, we're out there to kill an animal and to have meat, and we get that. And for years and years and years, I never, ever thought twice about what was on top of an animal's head when I pulled the trigger or threw an arrow. I just want to get us back to some of those basics that we can agree on and police ourselves a little bit. You know, out west, you know, you guys maybe don't have this, but the poaching problem out west is huge. And so we're doing all we can.
Yeah, we've got a lot of that. Yep. Yeah, we've got a lot of, I mean, and I know you do too, Joe, a lot of poaching. I mean, the farther north, especially in Michigan, I mean, you get a ton of guys shooting out of their car at night with spotlights.
And just the it's rampant everywhere, and it's a lot of it, I think, has to do with the gratification and the superstar status we give these hunters that kill big bucks, and it's like 30 seconds of fame, but some of these guys, that's their life.
Yeah, and I like that Carl brought that up earlier, and it kind of ties into actually why we started Hot Boga in the first place. Just for the fun of hunting. We wanted to have fun hunting.
Yeah.
It's not a trophy kill highlight show
There's sad stuff. I mean, like, some of the best moments I've ever had were not from the kill. It's maybe sitting around the fire with somebody. You look back and past deer hunts and deer camps, and it's like, that was a really hard time in my life, and that was a really good thing to do. Or, man, that was just the most fun I've ever had with a bunch of guys.
Yeah, and it doesn't help to then also shoot a big buck.
Yeah, I'm not saying that's the other side of this. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting a mature buck, and there's not anything wrong with being excited for someone who shoots something that's unique and hard to get.
I don't either. I think that's all great. And we work hard a lot of times, and sometimes the harder you work, the bigger the payoff.
You've earned that, feels like, the when public you're on land. Public land hunting.
Well, and going back to what you said, Carl, I mean, you know, why do you hunt? And when did it become killing? And, you know, I think to me, the most appealing part, and there's the meat, which is close to the top. There's getting a big deer there and everything else. But for me, the adventure of just going out in the woods, being by yourself, trying to, you know, the challenge and the adventure is just, it's hard for me.
To explain that to a non-hunter, I think that's maybe the most important part, is like the strategy and the thinking it through and the planning and the right. And something always is a little different. You got to shake it up.
Yeah.
Come back,
you're uncomfortable. The tips of my toe are still black from the frostbite that I got.
Exactly,
in Colorado,
right.
You know, and it's just like, you feel like a man out there. And I don't mean that in like, I don't know how I mean that, I guess. You just feel like you're supposed to be there. It's what you're supposed to be doing.
Primitive stirring.
Well, I was thinking when I was freezing my ass off up in hills, and it wasn't that bad. It was only 13 degrees or something overnight.
No, it's nothing.
And I'm, you know, building my fire, and I never really ever make campfires. And so I had some fat wood for my brother-in-law, who was down in the bottom fishing the Snake River and trying to catch a steelhead. And I was up there freezing my ass off, but I was just absorbing it. I was loving it. And no, I wasn't seeing the bull I wanted. And I shot a lot of smaller bulls, and I elected this time to be that, if you will, trophy hunter. Because we've seen them. We've seen them big, and you know, there's other places they live. They're big, but in this case, it just wasn't my year. So I just absorbed the adventure. I've rafted it. Like when I took my 71-year-old friend in the year he killed his first elk, you know, we rafted that thing and pulled two bulls out, and it was an adventure. And I like making adventures every time I go afield. I do that with my kids. I feel like let's make something interesting. Let's go up and find these Indian graves we know about on a particular camping adventure. I just try to mix it up and make it an adventure no matter what.
Yeah.
I've biked in Health Canyon. I've hiked in 13 miles to a water source and camp by myself. Never seen a person for, you know, 6 days in these places. And
wow,
that to me is just, that's real. And I can't imagine scaling a mountain like, let's say, McKinley.
Yeah.
Just to climb and slog the heights it takes to do that stuff. Even though I've done some of that, I enjoy being out. But there's something missing if I'm not hunting. I'm up there for a purpose, and I don't find the purpose other than going to the peak. Whereas hunting, there's a purpose. And even though you don't get to the peak, you don't get that animal, let's say, there's just this wonderful feeling of accomplishment and purpose. And I guess that's what I, I dislike most of all. And I guess all the peripheral things, like the photo I sent you, all the peripheral things that happen through nature or whatever, that's the highlight. And that's what I live for. You know, you can see the curvature of the earth almost on that picture. And I just like the beauty of nature, and I just being out there is a great thing, no doubt.
Yeah, it's a very real. I think it's a very real experience. I mean, and real in the sense that there's pain, there's reward. Struggle.
The struggle is the victory sometimes. So when it all boils down to
right. Yeah, exactly.
I like it.
So Carl, you said you shoot a longbow. Why longbow, not a recurve? That's just that question.
Well, I actually have both. Yeah, I've got both. I love my recurve because my elbow is, the hand shock on my original longbow, which I donated to some other poor guy. I just like the feel of the recurve, but I just recently acquired two new longbows, and one's a takedown that I've always wanted to do another trip to Alaska and go in for caribou or moose and or moose with a takedown longbow. I just love the simplicity, the lightweight. I love a lot of things about that. And it's ironic that a dad that was a gunsmith would see me with this bow. And I always talk to my dad when I'm out there, and he just laughed. It was like the first time I took a fly fishing trip with my girlfriend in high school, and her dad set us up, and I was catching these amazing 25-inch trout with a fly rod. And it was it just fired me up for this new thing I'd learned. And when I showed my dad, he was kind of that era of World War II era. And when I showed him the fly rod, he looked and he wondered why all this line on the ground. And he reached over in his ear and grabbed an automatic reel. He says, "Son, you need one of these." And he grabbed this little lever with his pinky finger and reel all this line up instantly. And I was like, well, that's kind of cool, but no, I think I'm going to stick with this manual system here. Yeah. And you just think of the way he grew up versus what fly fishing meant to me or means to me now at this age. But, you know, it's just the simple things, and we each have to embrace what we love about something and stick with it and, you know, empower others to do the same and mentor others and have a land ethic. You know, report those people that aren't doing the right thing, or educate them first, and they don't have the, you know, pass the attitude test, you report them then. But you know, there's a lot of things we can do out in the landscape to make it better. And I think that's kind of my bottom line, is just leaving things better than we found them.
Yeah. So speaking of adventure, I got to ask, how's your season been going this year?
Well, this year I was super stoked to see my wife get her first buck. She got a non-typical. In your world, it would be a 9x9, but out west, it's pretty much, you know, an 8-point, if you will. But it was a basic 4-point mainframe, still in velvet, with just stickers all over it. It was a really cool deal. And to see her get her first buck, it was just a really neat deal. She's waited 54 years to do it. She said she wanted to do it last year. I packed her into the Cascades of Oregon to do it, and we were fogged out. And it's just it's one of those things that's really satisfying. I feel like I've killed enough in my life. I don't have to always kill. I just never have felt like it's always the priority. And so last year I actually guided both archery and rifle, so I didn't get a chance to big game, so I missed it this year. But even though I didn't take an elk this year, I was super stoked at my trip and how physically able I still am. I always said when I took my friend Russ from Michigan into Hell's Canyon that if I can do what he does at 71, and hell, I felt like I was 101 on this trip, but he did it, and I know I can do it by 71. We'll keep plugging away and, you know, just keep going and doing it.
You got to bring a guy a little bit less in shape than you.
Then you feel really good.
Yeah, then you feel a little bit
better. That's why I bring all you guys with me.
I do that in bear country only.
Yeah, that's right. You just got to be faster than the other guy.
Exactly.
So you're a guide. Yeah, you're a guide.
Battle Creek Outfitters is a Bend-based outfitting business, and I've guided the last 3 or 4 years with them. So we had some holdings. They basically guide off of private land holdings. Okay. There are various outfitters in various states that have permits for private and public, or public only, or private only. And this organization that I worked with only had private land holding. We had some big leases and some phenomenal country to hunt. And I ended up getting a call up after my boss had a heart attack in camp. Survived a, you know, a Widowmaker kind of heart attack. Jeez. And I was guiding the next thing I know. And it was real fun. I wasn't sure I was ready for archery guiding, but you know, that was fantastic. And day two, one of my clients of two got a real nice bull. He's a Wisconsin guy. I wouldn't say he's a cheesehead, but he did wear a kind of Wisconsin-style hat. But yep. it was yep. fun, and it was a learning experience. And then rifle is always a learning experience as well with folks that are maybe not as accomplished in hunting and all the things that we are as we live our life in the West and hunt a lot, and we take it for granted,
yeah,
which we don't want you to do.
So guiding. Yeah. That's a very unique experience that, you know, only a handful of people have. You know, how is that? I'm sure that's probably made you a better hunter. Is that true? I mean, are you learning more because you're just spending more time, or is it
babysitting half the time?
Yeah. What do you learn from being a guide?
Well, if you turn the triangle or the funnel, you know, analogy where with a gun, you can shoot things out to number of hundreds of yards. If you take that funnel, narrow it down. I think archery was the first big thing. I learned, like I said, 97, 98 in Oregon, I shot a bull in archery range with a rifle. Mm-hmm. I just didn't feel like that was an ethical thing for me. And the second year definitely solidified that I could do this with a bow. Why am I doing it with a gun? And it just didn't seem fair to me. So that's when I really got into archery, and it did make me a better hunter, and it makes me a better hunter every single year. And again, I'm not the compound guy that has lots of opportunities out past 40 yards or whatever. I'm the guy that's going to shoot at 20 yards or less, and I love that. And I've challenged a lot of my friends that are compound guys, and I'm certainly not here to sell any of you on converting, but I believe for myself, and it's an individual choice, that it's a way more rewarding way to go. You're not fussing with all this stuff, and you just real simple, put a bow and an arrow together and a you know, stick on a string and start shooting. And that instinctual knowledge of knowing where that arrow goes, very rewarding. And I can shoot all day long. I can snap, you know, a arrow out at a stump or at a grouse. And I just love just being footloose and fancy free and not a lot of complications with the equipment. And I like that a lot. So I think that made me a better hunter. I think I learned patience. I'm a really impatient guy. And it was like rock climbing. It really taught me focus and patience. And I think that's what traditional archery can do for folks and kind of get them back in touch with getting a little closer to nature. I think that's awesome. I just don't think archery, to me, is that challenging when an animal doesn't know you're there 40, 50 yards away. Again, it brings back the gun analogy. And I don't know. It's a matter of priorities and what you individually seek as a challenge and what you embrace and what your ethic is. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's just kind of how I go about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like the thoughts on it. I'm a compound hunter. I shot my buck this year with a compound, but I definitely like the simplicity that you speak of in the close. I like getting animals as close as I can before I kill them. I like the simplicity of it. I fear that I don't have the time to invest truly home to be able to feel 100% confident to make that clean, quick, ethical kill that I strive for.
You know, the thing that I've, you know, I just switched, and Carl, actually, you and I have been talking for quite a long time on and off, but you were part of the reason why I switched, or at least you kind of encouraged me along the way. But one of the best parts is just shooting. I mean, you can shoot at a leaf and you don't mess up your arrow. It doesn't fly, you know, too far if you put some of those, whatever those small game tips are called. What are those things called again?
Field points.
No, not field points. The thing with the claw.
The judo.
The judo points.
Yeah, the judos.
But yeah, it takes some. It's a discipline for sure. But you know, at the end of the day, archery is challenging. Whether it's a compound bow or if it's a long bow that you've a self bow, you know, something you made. At the end of the day, it's still really hard, and it's really rewarding. Whether it's a latest new breed bow, or if it's something out of a stick you found in the woods, that's a product placement. Yeah, go new breed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, every individual, and I challenge my friends that I've hunted around and with, and guys that have tested my packs and worn my product. But I just challenge them and say, tell me how many bulls you've killed an archery season that are beyond traditional archery range. And they just give me that deer in the headlights look. Yeah. So one of the guys that are a group of three or four that were compound guys has switched to traditional. And the fact from their experiences with four guys in Hell's Canyon is an example of where they hunt, big open country, but all of the kills were within traditional archery range. Really? And I challenged those guys and said, look, I hear stories of guys flinging arrows, and that's really not what we want here, right? Flinging, injury, you know, animals getting away, injured. It's not what we want. And yet you guys are afraid to take the time to get down to the basics and learn how to shoot. And I'm self-taught. I think a lot of us are. We probably have lots of bad habits, but joining a club and shooting a traditional course. And I had a course next to my home, and now I've got traditional archery 3D targets at my home. And I think it is a discipline, and you can't take it lightly. And I think you got to go out and shoot. But
yeah, you got to earn
it. The basics. You do, and you got to start close. And my theory on that is I just would shoot multiple shots at 10 yards and make sure I had it down. And in fact, I've never, ever done the things that some guys with compounds have done, doing the whole Robin Hood arrow thing. But even at 10 yards, you know, you focus, and then I would make on my targets a smaller black dot and begin to find the dot and begin to get away from shooting targets and shooting an object that has no dot. You've got to pick a spot and learning to do that with your brain. And pretty soon I was shooting less and shooting better. And that came after the longbow experience, where I was getting some hand shock and my elbow was aching. And when I went to the recurve, and time, as you say, time is a compressor of what we can accomplish. But I think that shooting less made me a better shooter, actually. And I just take 15 minutes and go out, and I'd have a disciplinary sort of method I went about in shooting. And as I went through my routine, I felt like my shooting got better. And I always started out with close, and then I did a variation of distance from I just step back, turn around, and shoot, not knowing the distance. And I challenged my brain that way. And before long, you'd be surprised how quickly it happens. It's the shooting that, like James said, really was rewarding. And I'm making my own arrows, all the things, and learning to shoot heavy weight forward arrows, single bevel, two blade broadheads, and your own paint schemes. And that became really enjoyable to make all my own tackle, except someday I'm going to make a self bow, but I'm not quite there yet.
Hmm. Do you shoot truly instinctive, or do you use some type of aiming,
like the tip of your arrow?
Yeah. Do you use any of those methods, or do you just
treat the arrow I think I went from the instinctive, if you will, specific description of how you shoot to a three under or a gap shooting. When people say you're aiming off the tip of your arrow, it's still instinctive. Your brain's got to do all the math.
Right.
And yeah. I really like that. I'm trying to embrace it even more. And right now the kids are one finger over, two under, and I'm trying to just let that happen. And if they feel like they want to do something different, but I've never made a shot over 25 yards. I practice out to 30. And I know guys with recurves that are very competent, even longbows that have shot 30 to 45 yards.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
That's not in my game. It's not in my wheelhouse. I just won't do it. I limit myself. In fact, 25 yards, I missed a 365 bull way back in 2003 on one of my first trips into Hell's Canyon with that bow, because I had one arrow. I didn't have my quiver on it yet, and that's the way that went. But it's all good and fun, and it's great just to challenge yourself and watch and learn, and just to see the progress. That's really rewarding. I think that's the part I love about traditional archery.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. It was actually not so hard for me to switch because, and Joe and I have talked about this at length, most of our shot, I've had one shot at 40 yards once with my compound bow. And this year, the shot that I took on the deer was 28. That was probably my second longest shot I've ever taken. We just, at least where I hunt, I don't have a 50, 60 yard view or a, you know, a shooting window, but we have a lot less open spaces here in the big woods in Michigan, probably in Pennsylvania too.
Yeah, makes sense. And I've actually learned a little bit of technology. I only use a rangefinder anymore on a rifle hunt. I was introduced on a rifle hunt in 11 when I took my friend to Hell's Game for his first bull. But I figured it out because I didn't have all the fancy VDS dials and things on scope. But when it comes to traditional archery, we typically aren't ranging things, and that's the other part of the simplicity, all the gadgets and things I didn't want. And yet I still will carry it now on a traditional hunt and actually challenge myself and range various things to see if I'm on.
Right.
And once I know my wall, my periphery, my boundary of my longest shot, you know, an animal comes in, I can take the shot or not. If I know he's out, I'm not going to take the shot. So those are all nice little adjuncts, I guess, we can all integrate into our way we hunt.
Yeah, I'm going to admit I use a rangefinder. I'm not great at I mean, I feel like if I'm sitting there with somebody and I'm guessing the range, I'm better. But when a deer comes, that goes out the window.
And I don't want to be at the spot where everything had gone right, except for my ability to judge distance.
But you could say that about every part. Everything sure. could go, you know, was all right except for my ability to shoot a bow.
I'll get too excited and that's like 50 yards away.
No, yeah, I think my range, my eyes are like different, you know, when I see any deer.
Your heart starts pumping.
Yeah. So, Joe, let's give Carl one final question. Any final questions for him, thoughts before we wrap this
up? I got a good one. I've been thinking.
Ooh.
I did a little reading on you in your conservation background and just how active you are with just different conservation groups and stuff. And I just recently signed up for the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. I got a 3-year membership, and then I've been talking to the local chapter about an upcoming event and trying to help out. Because as you see it, I see it as well, and that's dwindling hunting numbers. But my question for you is, what do you see as the biggest future problem to hunting? Dwindling public land or dwindling hunter numbers?
Could I say neither of those?
Yes, you can, because this is a completely open forum.
Well, and I haven't done any Googling of you, Joe, but here's my deal.
Don't do it. You don't want to.
Yeah, don't do it.
Find some horrible things. Mostly written by us.
College was rough. Let's just, no Googling.
Oh, you weren't at Yale, were you? Okay.
No. I wasn't at college much when I was there either. So, in all fairness, I was in the woods.
That's a good place to be. So, I think it's apathy. I think it's a lack of initiative. I think a lot of the things that engage us in the outdoors, and we take that land for granted, whether it public or whatever it be, I guess we all just think things are so temporary, and we get resigned to the fact that things change. I have to pay to park, and it kills me when I go places where I have to pay to park, because I don't pay to park anywhere in Bend, Oregon. But I'm not used to sitting in traffic either. And you know, these things are what I call the boiled frog syndrome.
Yep.
And if we sit there and let these things whittle us down to where we don't stand up and fight, I just feel like that apathy is the biggest issue, and lack of education. And I want to say one thing about what we as hunters, we consider ourselves conservationists, and I challenge every hunter out there that's not a member of these peripheral groups. I really think that we have to step our game up and get into more of these groups. I mean, I donate to TRCP. I'm a BHA member lifetime, and a number of other things I've mentioned. I challenge other hunters to go beyond just using the word we're conservationists, and say, okay, besides my Pittman Robertson money, what else am I doing for wildlife? Am I volunteering my time? Am I giving money to a group because I can't give them time? We've got to get off our butts as hunters and clean up our act and be educated in the issues. Get involved in wherever it may be, in New York State or Michigan or Mississippi, get off our butt and get involved in make friends and educate them. Take it upon yourself to educate yourself on the facts. And I think that's the best thing we can do. I really believe in making things a better place than you left them. And we each have a way to do that within our own heart and our own abilities. So just make it a project for yourself and say, I'm going to do this, and make it a goal, whatever, and get your kids out more, or take someone hunting. You know, there's all kinds of opportunities out there. So
I love your
answer. Back,
way better than I could ever imagine. I like that answer. That's,
well, don't be a freeloader and you know, give a crap.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Really it.
Yeah.
Well, in my biggest.
Don't just buy guns and ammo, you know, and be, I'm just going to go out there and enjoy the land. But do something to better it, you know. It could be a million different things. But finding your heart,
right.
Place.
We're our own worst enemy sometimes, and that's with any group
you belong to. It's human nature.
It is.
And I'm older than you guys, and I've seen my share of it. And I'm not that old, but I just feel like, you know, if I sat around the campfire with you guys, you know, we do this until midnight.
Yeah.
And we would be so energized to get back up the next morning, go out and do our thing and do it again the next night. And those are the things that need to happen. We kind of got to, you know, reach a little farther out for some not low hanging fruit, if you will. We just have to kind of stretch our minds a little bit. But being educated and then re-educating others, I think, is what we don't do enough of as hunters. And so I'm always, here's one, and let me end on this because I tend to rant, but we'd have these barbecues, you know, with a lot of folks, and Bend is eclectic. It's got people from all over in every country and every state, I swear. And so we'd have barbecues in the summer, and I'd marinate because it helps folks feel better about what they're eating and sometimes mask what they're eating. So I'd get these comments from people that were like, God, this is really good. What is it? And I debate saying what it is, but I really always wanted them to know that that's moose, or it's elk, or it's deer, or it's caribou. And I made it a point. Yeah, and I'd make a point to say, well, I marinated and this and that, but it's really good if you don't marinate as well. But they would be in love with it. So get this. So this last summer, my good friend who was in my wedding had his wedding at our property, and I did a big – vast array of wild game for the rehearsal dinner. And one of the things I threw in was some smoked bear. And I thought, you know, no one's going to eat that. I'll get most of this myself. So I wasn't going to use a whole big ham to share with them. It went the fastest, and I had the most questions. They thought it was fabulous food. I had people from San Francisco asking me about hunting, and did I hunt myself? Did I go in the wilderness myself? Did I butcher it myself? People were intrigued that I actually, you know, killed my own bear and harvested it and do all the things I do. And we do as hunters. They're infatuated. So get out and do that kind of thing.
The food is a great way in.
It is. And you bring up a great point. And I don't know how to take this point and get to where I want to go, but I talk a lot too. So I'll just break it down, and it's going to sound chaotic and chunked, but guys like, yeah, and Tom will edit it and I'll sound like a genius.
Or not.
You got guys out there like Joe Rogan, just different guys on social media, which are in the mainstream media. And we're, right now we're in a media, we're in this podcast medium, this verbal.
We're very fringe though.
Doo-doo of words. But you're seeing these guys that are bringing hunting to the epicenter of media and people are seeing it that are non-hunters, that are vegans or however you want to classify them, or vegetarians. And you're seeing the acceptance of it by a lot, this broad different social classes. And then, you always have the naysayer in there. You always have the person that wants to attack. And what I see, and it's very discouraging, and I can see it hurting the growth of hunting and conservation and the procurement of your own healthy organic quote unquote meats, is the guy that gets on there. I buy my license, I'm a conservationist, I give my money to the state, or I give my money to this person, and more or less fight ignorance with ignorance, and sometimes way more ignorance, down to like second grade name calling. And I see it crushing the good of hunting and the real meaning of hunting, and And you see one guy doing a great thing and opening the eyes of people to the reality of what we do out there and gaining acceptance. And then you've got Joe Schmo from South Kentucky that comes on there and wants to attack hate with hate or ignorance with ignorance. Well, and I actually see that as our biggest downfall as hunters, because there are a lot of people getting off their butts, and people have seen what we need to do to protect our lands and protect our numbers. But then you have those that have not been educated. And I think education is,
I think they're doing a great job of getting the word out. And especially for this group, I'm going to hit the millennial thing again, because that's, where you are kind of our specialty.
Yeah.
Not me.
You're like, what? Yeah, Joe, wait, you're not a millennial, Joe.
You can pipe down.
I know.
By 6 months. Come on.
Well, hey, I'll take all six of those months.
Yeah, that's right.
For a generation of young guys and girls out there that, again, have been so screen-focused their whole lives, I think those guys, ironically, through a screen, using that in a way to re-romanticize getting out in the wild, taking on the challenge, doing what Carl's been talking about this whole time, is embracing it. Cam Haynes, another huge guy that's all about, right, is just putting on the miles, doing the work, doing what other people aren't willing to do. And I think that's where the cool thing about that social media aspect of hunting and podcasting can be a benefit, because some idiot like me in Michigan can get access to some phenomenal information from a guy like Carl.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
And can teach up the fools like us and make us better hunters. So that's pretty cool.
And Tom, I'm glad you spoke. And this is, I got to say, your first podcast, he's standing in for Jared tonight. Phenomenal job.
I'm nailing it.
Tom, do you have a final question here for Carl?
I don't have a question. I just want to say thanks for taking the time and talking with us, like I said, and teaching us up a little bit. It's been a fun talk.
Oh, I don't know about that. I got lots of blog posts that probably just are spinning out in the, what do you call that world, your world, that whole cyber world.
Internet.
They're just spinning out the internet. Yeah, that thing.
Yeah.
The interwebs.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of an Apple IIe? Anyway, ERS-80. Those are the computers that I sat in front of.
I saw a picture of it on a show.
Yeah, I think I saw a documentary on Netflix.
Yeah.
Hey, I embrace technology. I'm not good at it, and it's obvious because I don't have a videographer along with me when I hunt. But here's some thought. There was no question really from Tom or James at the end there, but I think that...
Oh, I got a question, but I'm waiting on it.
Okay, all right. Well, let me say this. I think we'd almost do better to have some video out there of us hunting where we don't highlight so much on whispering in a tree stand and staring at the grass and... What we see is a terrain and a landscape, and we talk about what all the Leopold talked about in how to, make it a better place, and yet show the farm to table. That's what I brought up for Oregon hunters in my white paper. Once I was on the board here, I said, look, if we're losing numbers, we got to appeal to people that know nothing about hunting. Let's not keep this organization a bunch of pot-bellied, gray-haired, white 50-year-old men and older.
Yeah.
Let's appeal to the Hispanics. Let's appeal to the others out there and women. And let's appeal to the people in Portland that might be farm to table. And let's have a feast. And let's bring our food. And let's show what it's about out there.
Yeah, that's funny. That's the first thing when I talk to non-hunters and I'm trying to convert them or get them to think that hunters aren't terrible people. Is that's one of the first things that I go to is it's the most pure meat you could get.
Yeah, it fits well. I mean, that's how, my wife, my daughter and I eat vegetables from a garden that's two blocks away and meat. And then the only really the things that we buy are things that aren't grown here.
Right.
And at the end of the day, like people can get excited about that. Younger generations can get excited about that. Yeah. That
connects to their values.
Yeah.
And it's just salmon. Something when you do it.
Go ahead. Absolutely. And fish, this is the thing that I've never understood. Why is it okay to catch a fish clobbered on the head and eat a salmon fillet, and yet people can't see us doing the same thing in some humane way, ethical way of doing our own processing and killing an animal, bringing it to table? And so I brought this up to OHA in our recruitment and retention, where we were losing members, and we've got to appeal to these younger folks. Well, what's wrong with appealing to people that don't even hunt? Let's show them what it's like and how wonderful the food is, and that we can have these gourmet meals with this food. And we did it all ourselves. No different harvesting a hog or a cow we raised on our property, or chickens that we end up slaughtering, lamb. I just think that people move so far because it's violent with a gun or whatever, but they've never been to a slaughterhouse, I promise you.
Yeah, and,
so we want to. We all want to be ambassadors. Everyone that has a gun or a bow in our hands should be an ambassador for the sport and educate people. Hand them a BHA or a whatever membership application you carry with you. Talk to people and educate them. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, I mean, and the contradictions for fishing and hunting. You know, people that are like, I do catch and release fishing, but I couldn't do hunting. So you hook a fish, you drag it around, you tire it out, you take a picture with it. Well, I can't breathe. And then you throw it back in the water and you're now very humane. And I'm not saying like it's terrible to do that. I'm just saying, I mean, is there really a huge difference between that and catching it and eating it or shooting it and eating it? All right.
Yep.
So since I'm talking, I'm going to do the final wrap up question. And it's more of actually a gear question because we haven't talked too much about this. Carl, in your pack, what is the most useless thing, the thing that you have in your pack that you know it's, you know, it's not very helpful, or what's the thing that you have that you should have left back in your the cabin or wherever, your car or wherever you were coming from this year?
My cell phone.
Okay, wow.
I know. What? Hitting right at the heart of the millennial. I didn't want to carry a camera. I could have videoed and done all this stuff, but I did it with my phone. And I ended up having service on top where I never had service really before. But I didn't need that damn thing. But I used it as a camera. And then everything's on my phone so I can text and email. But literally, I pare down every trip as to what I've used, two trips. And if I haven't used it, I pitch it out. And I had to take more warm clothes and more food because it's going to be cold, all on my back at 65 pounds up 4,500 vertical. And I lost a glove. And because of that, I had to go all the way back down the next day. I made a hunt out of it in a different drainage or two, but I had to go back down to the river and get another set of gloves. And it dawned on me that, you know, as crazy as gearless and all the other things go, rookie errors add up, and that was a big one. But, you know, I still made a hunt out of it, and I didn't have any cramps. That's a first in that country. I never cramped, so I managed my water and my electrolytes and did my emergencies morning and night, and I got through it. But I think when we talk about gear, we could go on and on. I got all kinds of blog posts and things that help people do that too. And it's all specific maybe to your region or your hunt.
Right.
I certainly wouldn't carry, you know, 40 pounds of pack on my back to go into Michigan woods. You know, it'd be a gallon of water and some little doodads and a kill kit. But, you know, it's different and specific wherever we go. The context is set by our trip and our adventure and our days and the weather.
Well, that's a good answer. I feel like that's the most non-superficial answer we've got so far. Usually it's like, it's a third knife. Or for me, mine was always the rifle that I took because I never ended up using it. All right. Well, Carl, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. We really appreciate it. Love having you on. We'd like to have you back at some point, too.
Thanks for the invite, fellas. Pleasure going over philosophizing, I guess, with you guys. I look forward to doing it in the future as well. We'll stay in touch.
Absolutely. Great talking to you, sir.
All right, you guys. Take care.